and welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Larry Magid, co-founder of Electric Factory Concerts. Electric Factory Concerts, 17,000 concerts, I do believe, including international events like the Atlantic City Pop Festival, Live Aid, and Live 8. Larry has been on every council and advisory board for the arts and various philanthropies that you could imagine. He's also the founder of the Philadelphia Music Alliance, and he's a Tony winner as well. And with us as well, Derek Gilman returns. He is an educator and advocate. He is distinguished teaching professor for art history and museum leadership at Drexel University and the executive director for University Collections and Exhibitions, which will mount Electrified, 50 Years of Electric Factory, an exhibit celebrating the impact that Electric Factory and Electric Factory Concerts had on our American culture. That's what we're going to be talking about today. So welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Larry, let's get started with you. You started out as a DJ, Larry Magic, and then what went wrong?
Well, what went right? the times were so strange. Electric Factory had opened in February 68. The building was not air conditioned, so we took the summer off. And as it turned out, I got a call from High Lit, of all people. He was going to run WDAS FM, and the popular idiom of that era was rock or free form radio. And he called me up and he said, would I like to go on the air? And I said, I hadn't thought about it, but I did. I actually was on the air for 8 weeks when I was 16 years old in high school on an oldie show on DAS AM. And the host was, or the disc jockey was, a Cannonball. And somehow we wandered into the, I wanted to enter the station with some friends and stuck around and was asked if I wanted to come back and be on the air. So I lasted 8 weeks, I think, seven more weeks. And then when this thing came up, I thought about it, and the money was too great to turn down. It was $55 a week. And I had a show with a close friend, Paul Fishkin, who later had his own record company. And he was the person that convinced Stevie Nicks to have a solo career. And when everybody else was against it, thought it was going to ruin her career and Fleetwood Mac. And obviously she became the largest selling female artist of that era. So I was on the air for a couple of months, and Electric Factory reopened, and that was it.
Could that be replicated? When you opened Electric Factory, there were a lot of great venues here in Philadelphia, places that you could hear any kind of music. And yet you open this and you start booking these shows. And I look this up. Your first 3 months, you have Hendrix and Joplin and Cream appear.
And Zappa.
And Zappa too.
Yeah, we had everybody as soon as we could. We actually opened February 2nd. We had the Chambers Brothers. Yeah, we had a press party, I believe, with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the original Blood, Sweat, and Tears, but it was not a public event. And yeah, we had you name it, anybody of that day, we had.
Well, what was the magic? What made Electric Factory so special? And because, again, Philadelphia had these amazing sights. This was a music town back then.
It's always been a music town, and a great music town with great audiences. We came along at the right time, just as everything was starting to break, but it was pretty much still an underground experience. And there was a community here, and there was a small rock club called The Trauma, and run by a fellow by the name of Manny Rubin, who was an amazing guy. And he had folk clubs, and there were many jazz clubs. There was just a lot of music in Philadelphia. But we had an idea. We were, you know, that we were right, and it worked out, and that predated any radio station playing this music. And the more we played it with the up and coming acts, the bigger we became. And then it laid the groundwork for concerts, shows at the Spectrum. We did the first alleged rock concert. Allegedly the first concert. Electric Factory did a show called Quaker City Rock Festival, and we had five acts. We had Buddy Guy, Junior Wells Blues Band. We had the Chambers Brothers. We had Moby Grape, Big Brother and the Holding Company. We had Janis Joplin and Vanilla Fudge. We sold 20,000 tickets. They were $4, $5, and $6. Which was the norm in those days, and you know, they just, and the rest was really history. We just kept going on, and we created a great experience for people and fans in Philadelphia.
So out on the West Coast, you got Bill Graham starting, and out here on the East Coast, there's Larry Magid. And how did you take it beyond Philadelphia? How did you become, well, impresario, visionary? I don't know how. Was anyone else even thinking in these terms?
Yeah, there were a half a dozen guys that had clubs who were popping up in different cities. We didn't know each other. We never spoke prior to opening up the club. So just, it was the times. And you know, we were fortunate enough to realize that I was an agent in New York. I was the low man on the totem pole at the biggest agency. And I could see what was happening. And my bosses were not even thinking about this type of music. And I could see what was happening. You know, the first inclination was we had Cream, and they came over and they played the Cafe Agogo, which was a small club in Greenwich Village. They did a million shows, but they couldn't stay over here because of the immigration policies, green cards. You could only stay for a certain amount of time, and then coming from England, and then an American act would have to reciprocate to go to London. But there was a booking that came across my desk that Cream was booked for a debutante party in outside of Detroit, and they got $5,300 and three first-class round-trip tickets from New York. And I said, this is it. And I was able to convince Herb Spivak, who was a jazz promoter and wanted to be in the white rock business, I convinced him to open up a club, because I thought that was the right start. It actually was. I was correct in my assumption that it would work, and it did. And we had these big acts that the kids knew about. And it just built.
When you were talking about, what did you call that scene back then? And to me, it was underground radio.
Yeah,
because you knew something that nobody else did. You knew these acts from albums that you didn't hear on the radio, but FM was playing them.
And
you were presenting them in clubs.
Yeah, it was definitely underground, but that was the hip phrase of the day. Earlier in my lifetime, the underground radio was WHAT and WDAS playing R&B music, and it was underground to white kids, because that was completely different. So that word was a touchstone, and we were the underground until we started doing show after show after show, and it wasn't the underground anymore. It was the scene, and we were able to build off of that more than anyone else.
You were prescient. You beat Woodstock to the punch.
Yeah.
We were talking to our Matt Cord just before this, and he was asking about the Atlantic City Pop Festival. So you seem to be able to catch the wave before every other surfer is in that water.
Well, what happened was the the Spectrum opened in 67. It opened with a two-day spectacular jazz festival that Herb Spivak put on, who had owned the Showboat Jazz Club and then later did a jazz concert. So I programmed my thinking after Herb, and I kept thinking that if you could have a festival with jazz, why couldn't you have other festivals? And as soon as we did that show, we started booking another festival. We called it the annual festival, and 6 weeks later we had the second annual. But I thought that, you know, that why couldn't we do this in the summertime? There wasn't anything going on in the summer at that point. There were no amphitheaters, you know, clubs. People didn't want to go into clubs. There were little outdoor venues here and there, 2,500, maybe 3,000 seats, and they've just had this idea. And Herb Spivak was driving down the shore. He saw the racetrack where we held it. Went in. We made a deal, and then I put the show together, and it was great. It was actually great, not only for the 40,000 people that came every day, but it was great for me to experience, and that gave me an impetus to just keep churning these things out. And the incredible thing was that this wasn't only a music experience, and it still isn't. The part of these shows are social, and there were more social there. And I've had people come up to me, actually had a fellow that worked for me, would come up and he said, we would go to these weekly shows. We called them dance concerts at times. And it didn't matter who was playing. It was just a happening, just an experience. And people trusted us enough to know they were going to get value out of their $4, $5, and $6 to see the show.
It was a community, and if you were on the road with these shows, you would go and see as many as you possibly could, and the old slogan, peace and love, for Woodstock. But something you said there, I thought, wow, there was something that you took away from this that Woodstock did not, and that was you got your money.
Yeah, well, the first thing you want to do if you're a promoter is be able to collect the money that Woodstock was just got away from the promoters that built it, all of a sudden it was upon them, and there was no choice but to open the Grace. They didn't get their fences up. We were fortunate because we were in a racetrack where we had walls and turnstiles, and it was a fixed venue. But we had an expansive outdoors, and it lent itself to be able to put that show on. The great thing was that we had a very futuristic stage that was designed by Buckminster Fuller, who was a true visionary, and built this stage, and you could hang sound and lights was important from any beam on the stage rather than stack it up, which at that point was the only way you could do it.
So you're a visionary even in the staging, and that kind of leads into, you're successful in that, one, you get the money out, you're able to plan, and you're able to control the situation. And that leads you to, I mentioned it at the beginning in introducing you, 17,000 plus concerts. But also, you're there to stage the big impossible ones, the ones like Herding Cats, Live Aid, Live 8, both in Philadelphia, of course. You produced shows, you did one your own, United We Stand, a benefit concert right after 9/11. It's that control and being able to do something in these grand scales that sets you apart.
Well, they're experiences, and you have no other thought than to be as calm as you possibly could be, because if you weren't, you can't expect anybody that was working on that particular show to be calm. And then would just say that somebody was rushing through or doing didn't have the right temperament. It just throws everything off. So there's no real choice because you can't show any panic. We only had 5.5 weeks to do Live 8 and 5 weeks to do Live 8. So there was no chance to really think about what you were doing, but to do it. But the whole secret is that just have good people around you working. And not only was my staff really good because we were well versed in not only concerts but stadium shows. We did a lot of them, mm-hmm. and not just in Philadelphia. So we really had some good people, and nobody gets ruffled. Nobody gets panicked.
Hey, if you're just joining us, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis. With us today, Larry Magid, co-founder of Electric Factory. Larry is, I guess you'd say, the architect and contemporary leader of the live entertainment business. I'm quoting the broadcast pioneers there. But his career highlights include on Broadway, Billy Crystal's 700 Sundays. We've already mentioned Live 8, Live Aid, you name it. You produced the reading of the Declaration of Independence on the Art Museum steps.
The Art Museum, July 4th. Yeah,
yes, you did that one
with Norman Lear.
And that was a fabulous show.
Yeah.
You've produced concert tours for Richard Pryor, Bette Midler, Billy Crystal, Patti LaBelle. Yes, you name it. Derek Gilman. We are going to get him into the conversation now. He's been the director of both the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and the Barnes Foundation. He returned to the academic life, and now he is distinguished teaching professor for art history and museum leadership at Drexel University and executive director, University Collections and Exhibitions. And when you've got 50 years plus of a company that had posters and staging and et cetera, all the ephemera that goes into this, it's great that we're going to actually see it. And so, Derek, I've got to ask you, how the heck do you curate a show like this? Did he just open the keys to the warehouse and you went in and I'll have two of those and give me one of that?
It was something like that. But actually, as you said, I'm at Drexel University, and this is a great collaborative project because Larry had very generously given his original material to Temple University, where it resides in their special collections unit. And Temple basically opened up their vaults to us and said, what would you like? And they said, you can have anything. And so it was just a plethora of amazing material, which for me is riveting because I'm a half a generation younger than Larry, but I'm old enough to have been very much part of his clientele, except I was in another continent. I was part of that generation. So I'm experiencing this from two sides. One is as a professional museum person who puts on exhibitions, going in to look at extraordinary material, thinking about how do you create a show. And at the same time, I'm in the way that Larry's reliving the 60s and 70s, and I'm reliving my teenage years and my early 20s, looking at this material, thinking, I saw them, and I saw them, and I remember them. I thought about how many shows I'd supervised over my museum career, and it was a large number. But I don't think I've had as much fun on an exhibition as I've had this one, because, first of all, it's one of those subjects which touches everybody, but it's also very personal, and it's personal for many of us. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're a Philadelphian, whether you're a Brit like me, if you're of a certain age. This was, as you've said to Larry, this was absolutely groundbreaking. It was a groundbreaking period. There's something about the 60s and into the early 70s, which was represented a radical shift in America and Western Europe, a cultural shift. And to have been part of that as a consumer is something actually quite significant. But then to come back to it as a museum professional and say, what can we take? So looking at these original posters of the opening concert, when Larry talks about Chambers Brothers opening, he shared with myself and a colleague some time ago about how the sound worked on that opening concert, and I was absolutely I was delighted because they were saying, you know, we thought about the sound quite late in this, and so we ended up putting two jukeboxes on the side of the stage for the first concert. You know, jukeboxes are just big speakers, basically. You think, well, yeah, that's really clever. And if I'd been in that situation, would I have thought of that? Perhaps. But it was a practical solution, and in many ways it does capture, I think, what Larry's achieved, because to create what he created over such a long time, on such a scale, and as you say, with Live Aid and Live 8 transcontinentally, requires an extraordinarily managerial capacity, somebody who can look at this, all the moving parts, and get it from conception to end product in a way that delights the consumer. Because, you know, other people could have tried to put on Live Aid or Live Aid, and Larry talked about the people who put on Woodstock, and in the end you could have a real muddle at the end. But the fact that these concerts came off and people remember them, and I don't tell you the number of people that I've talked to in the last few weeks who are younger than me, who do that, the equivalent of, where was I when JFK was assassinated? Where was I when Live Aid was on? What was I doing, you know, on July 13th, 1985? It really affected a huge number of people. One of the things that's fascinating for me is I've been teaching, using the Electrified show to teach my graduate students at Drexel exhibitions. And they're young, for the most part. And so it's a really intriguing exercise to say, who do you remember? Who do you know? If I give you all these names, who do you know? Now, remember, Electric Factory and Electric Factory concerts went up to almost before COVID. I mean, they had a huge period of time. So the bands that they produced actually are part of this younger generation. But in terms of the period that we've just been talking about, you and Larry have been talking about, in terms of the 60s, 70s, the beginnings, Atlantic City Pop Festival, and so forth, you know, that's an older crowd who was part of that. So you say to the students, who do you know? Don't think about it, but just tell me, put your hand up if you know these people. And then what's actually slightly shocking for people like me is who they don't know. And my favourite comment, and I think my students would allow me to say this, this was a group of undergraduates, and they said, Cream. We heard of a band called Bread, we think.
Oh, dear.
So it really makes you feel that, you know, makes you feel your decades.
I can't answer that. That the Kennedy question, which of course was the generation before us, you can say, where were you for Live Aid? Where did you watch the show? And I watched it in Dayton, Ohio, and I've got a young staff, and I was telling one about it, and I played for him the opening, and that amazing voice that says, it's 12 noon in London, 8 a.m. in Philadelphia. Mm. And I wanted to cry. I got tears in my eyes listening to that voice and remembering sitting there watching that on television and knowing that all of my friends, wherever they were, we were all watching it at that same moment. And, oh, it's a teary moment for me even now. Mm.
It was a remarkable experience. I was as big a fan as anyone, and fortunately, we pulled it off. Actually, the show in the U.S. ran to the exact allotted time. Maybe we were 30 seconds over, and on Live 8, the show in London ran 3 or 4 hours over. We were off on time, but that's not to say that their show wasn't good. Probably was not only just as good, but probably better, because they had the experience of putting bands back together like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. We had a great show, you know, with Mick Jagger and Tina Turner doing a duet together. We had Dylan and Keith Richards and Bill Wyman. We had a great show. There's no doubt about it. But it was a remarkable experience for everybody. You know, one thing that happened is that we got a call. How they even got our number, it certainly wasn't listed. We only had the phones for 5 weeks. We got a phone call from a hospital saying that they have a kidney for a recipient that was in our audience. And my secretary at the time took the call, Mary Smotrees, and somehow we found this concert goer, who's a young guy, and we medevaced them out of, to the hospital in time to get the kidney transplant. And I mean, at 90,000 people, we found this kid. Of course, we made an announcement from the stage, but you have to find the guy and you have to get to him and get him out of there because you only have a limited time to get a transplant. Especially back then, it was pretty brand new. So, and our show ran on time, and at the end of the show, which was different from the English show, we had two or three times the number of celebrities that came on stage to sing "We Are the World," which was the anthem for that show, which predated us. It was just a remarkable experience to get through that show, run it on time. I remember there was a big party afterwards with all the acts, and I was so spent. I said, "I'm going home. I'm going to sleep," because you know the luxury of sleep when you're putting a big thing like that together is minimal. You know, so for 5 weeks, I slept 4 or 5 hours a night, and leaving late at night and getting there the first thing in the morning because there was a lot to do every day. There was no time off, and we work from 6 a.m. till midnight.
And you were 5 hours ahead of England as well. Yeah. So they had to coordinate that.
Yeah.
Will we see anything from Live 8 and Live Aid in the exhibit? What are some of the items
that
will be on display?
For we've got a lot of great photographs from Live Aid as well as Live 8. It's going to be a huge montage wall of photographs. We've got a jacket, a Live Aid jacket coming up from Hard Rock International, who did the catering, plus some original menus. And there's other paraphernalia, but I think one of the things that's fascinating about Live Aid, because it was such a major performance across two continents, is the scale of it. So within the exhibition, there's an attempt to capture that scale.
You have Springsteen's guitar. You've got his Telecaster?
We've got the Mutt Telecaster, yeah.
And you have guitars. You have posters. Did I hear there was a car?
There's a car. Do you want to talk about the car, Larry?
Well, as part of advertising, promoting Electric Factory, because there's no radio to really promote it on. And so we came up with an idea to get a car and drive around. Well, it couldn't be just any car. So we got a 59 Cadillac limousine with the window separation between the driver and the passengers. We had art students not only paint the car, but paint the whole place inside and outside in Dayclo colors in various designs. The car was spectacular. It was just great. The colors just burst off. And then we had a sign on top, a wooden sign saying Electric Factory. And nobody knew what it was. We had our logo, which was a picture of Ben Franklin, because we wanted to tie in Philadelphia to electricity and whatever. And we drove it all around town. And it was great. However, when I went to see my mother, she asked that I park the car around the corner so none of her neighbors could see it. It was an amazing car. And then we have a Cadillac limousine, and it will be somewhat similar. So when you walk in, you'll get a feel for what you're going to see.
It will be parked outside there. When you walk in, you'll have passed it, because we want to use it in just the way that Larry and Electric Factory had originally, as a sort of beacon for the show. So it'll be parked outside. The show's taking place in the Paul Peck Centre on Market Street and the Bossone Research Centre, which is part of the College of Engineering at Drexel on Market Street. So there are adjacent buildings sort of across 32nd Street, and the car will be parked at the side of the Peck Centre with a sign on top of it which will reflect the original sign, which will advertise the show, and it'll be painted in very similar colors. And we've got the photograph of the original car. We've got art students.
It begins on September 22nd because there's a VIP frou-ha-ha the night before, and then it will be open to us raffled September 22nd through December 31st. It is a free exhibit.
It's free.
Which will, you know, we should take, everybody should grab their friends and go and see this and reminisce and get teary-eyed like I do when I see some of this stuff. We go to Drexel to find information about it. We can find it through your website.
We will be putting up information very shortly.
Larry, is it even possible at this point? Will there ever be another Larry Maggott or Bill Graham? Well, I mean, is it even possible?
I hope so, and better tempered.
You're so even-keeled, and it's fun to walk you around because walking you through the radio station, the various personnel here, everybody comes out and fangirls because you're here. But is it even possible to have somebody put on these kind of shows in the current climate of how shows are produced?
Well,
the big tours.
You know, you have to think back of what these shows really were. There was a theme to these shows, and Live Aid, the theme was help starving people in Ethiopia. It was not my idea. It was an idea of Bob Geldof and Mitch Ewer. How they got this off the ground was amazing. They actually started asking people, and not until Elton John agreed to do it, then he helped other people. But then they wanted to do something in America, and it had to be on the East Coast because of the time difference. So if they went to San Francisco, it was impossible to do that. And they actually wanted, you know, as just an aside, they wanted to do this in New York or on the Mall in Washington, D.C. And somehow, if I take any credit for anything, it was just to convince them to come to Philadelphia, Cradle of Liberty, hoping that England would take us back, especially in these times. But seriously, the idea was, in my mind, this social consciousness of things that were going on. You always want to help people. Your thought was, if I'm in the position financially or otherwise to do something. So that's what I took out of it. And that's the greatest feeling of being able to do it. Today, there are two large companies, and there are that do shows. However, there are individuals that put on festivals that are as capable as anyone. Graham, me, Harvey Goldsmith in London, maybe even better. And I watch these festivals. They're fantastic. They're just an amazing events. So, yeah, there are people that could do it, but it has to be for the right situation. Now, people have come up, can we do this for this disease or that disease for this cause? You know, and it's just you have to find somebody willing to do it and then acts willing to do it and to make have a strong enough show to make an impact. But again, it has to be about something and it has to raise social consciousness, which I think we did with Live Aid.
You've kind of touched on this, that Philadelphia was a music town. It is a music town. And does Philadelphia get the recognition that it deserves? Now, you also mentioned that helping others, and you have done amazing things for music in schools. You're a doer. You get behind your ideas and you get behind your beliefs. And one of the things that you did was the Philadelphia Music Alliance, which puts the plaques on Broad Street and works with the schools now, trying to get music education to the kids early enough that they can have careers, maybe as an impresario like you, maybe a performer,
so.
Maybe as a songwriter, maybe as an entertainment attorney. So it is moving forward, and I have to do the disclaimer here that I'm on the board of the PMA, and they will actually be on this show in the coming weeks to talk about the work that you have started there, and now you're working on a book about the Philadelphia history.
Well, the formation of the Music Alliance, along with a lot of other people in Philadelphia. A lot of people. You don't do one thing. You may have an idea, the germination of an idea, but it takes a lot of people to realize that the idea can come to life. And for me, I wanted to see the Philadelphians and the city get the recognition that it deserved. Not that I thought it deserved, but a lot of people thought it deserved. So we put this group together to not only celebrate our musical achievements, past and present, but to give the future an opportunity to blossom and work with music in the schools programs, have educational seminars, pass along the information, the education that we had to other people, and hope that it replenishes the entertainment pool in any genre. It could be an entertainment lawyer, could be the next great classical musician that takes that Philadelphia message across the world, like Andre Watts did, like Stan Getz did. At the end, it's endless. It's so this book is a coffee table book called From Philadelphia with Love and Music, and we're featuring at least the book keeps getting bigger every day, which is an issue, but at least 250 great artists. And I'm not talking about little people or mediocre people that had nice careers. I'm talking about people that had international acclaim.
So many of our artists are getting lost to history, too. We don't realize. Yeah. We might pass a house that's got a plaque on it, but then we walk by a street, and it's a street that's been named for someone that we have just, it's out of our cultural memory now.
Yeah, you walk along the street, which is one of the things that we have to correct. So you're walking, you're a young person, or you're in your 30s, and you come across a plaque. There's a Mario Lanza, which was a great star, big star. And you say, who's he? So we have to educate. That's another part of why this book is happening. And we're working on an app program that when you walk past one of these plaques, that you could use your app to get some biographical information if you want to.
You're seeing your students. Do they have an interest in this history beyond exhibiting it?
I think that it's more than that. I think that one of the really powerful things about this show, and indeed the project that Larry is talking about, that the history of Philadelphia music, is that rhythm is a really fundamental part of human experience. It underpins so much of what we do. When Larry was saying earlier that Philly is a great sports town, great sports performances are underpinned by rhythm. Music is essentially rhythm, but so much of what we do in our lives, just walking down the street, is rhythmic. And so of all the things that young people can engage with, music is somehow a very deep one. I wouldn't go as far as some people do to say that music is universe across the world, because there are forms of music which are quite hard for different cultures to grasp. But having said that, beat, rhythm, is fundamental across the world. And once you explain to people what musicians did, and if you play it, I think there's a huge amount of engagement that happens in music which you don't necessarily get in other areas of history.
I am so sorry to have to say this, but parting words, gentlemen?
I'd like to just say this. First of all, when I got the call about doing this, I was pretty flabbergasted, because I never envisioned anything. I never thought of anything like that. You know, you live it. It's just an experience day to day. Fortunately for me, I got into this business when I was 20 years old, and it's been my life, my whole existence. But if anyone had called me besides Drexel University, I don't know that I would have wanted to share those experiences. I'm pretty selfish when it comes to my memories. And I don't want to be the old guy in the corner telling stories. But, well, when I was a young man, this is what we did. And we had a guy named Bob Dylan. I didn't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy. But Drexel is the number two music business school in the country. And there are hundreds of schools offering music business courses, and in all spheres and realms of entertainment. And obviously, they have their own music school, but Philadelphia, number two school, Drexel University, putting this event on. That's I have to say, that's pretty heady.
Wonderful. That's a wonderful thing, and very generous of Larry. And the nice thing is that the music industry program has been totally all in on this, but serves so many other departments in Drexel, like the College of Engineering. We have a whole stage we're building with speaker stacks on it, with electrical engineers writing the panels. So this is just in the if Larry is as engaged by Drexel as he very kindly is, then I have to say Drexel is as engaged with Larry.
I think that's a beautiful ending. That's a beautiful close. Thank you both for being on today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to the show, Electrified, 50 Years of Electric Factory, celebrating, exploring the impact that Electric Factory and Electric Factory concerts had on our culture here. And it will start on September 22nd to the general public, run through December 31st. You can catch it Wednesdays through Saturdays, 1 to 7 during the week, and 12 to 5 on Saturdays. It will be there at the Peck Center Gallery and the Bassone Research Center at Drexel University. And more information at the Drexel website will be posted very soon. My guest today, Derek Gilman. He is Distinguished Teaching Professor for Art History and Museum Leadership at Drexel University and the Executive Director for University Collections and Exhibitions, which, of course, are mounting the exhibit Electrified, 50 Years of Electric Factory, an exhibition celebrating and exploring the impact that Electric Factory and Electric Factory concerts had on anyone who was attending live music events for over, 50 years. And again, the co-founder of Electric Factory Concerts, the legendary concert promoter, philanthropist, you name it, you can't over-enthuse, Larry Magid. And thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.